Hi, this is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer. We've edited down this episode of Vermont Edition.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On this day in 1912, if you were in Barrie, you could have heard Progressive Party presidential candidate Theodore Roosevelt address Vermonters thusly.
Here in Vermont, I feel we have a peculiar right to make an appeal on behalf of the Progressive Party. You men and women of Vermont represent the very type of American citizen in whom we must trust when we strive to make this government really a government by the people themselves, in the interest of all the people and not any one class.
You might have heard some cars in the background. A little bit surprising there for 1912, wasn't it? It wasn't actually 1912. That wasn't Roosevelt. It was John D. Alexander as Theodore Roosevelt 100 years later during a reenactment of the candidate's campaign stop in Vermont. That was one of several trips Theodore Roosevelt made to the state as vice president, president, and in this case, a candidate for the presidency, unsuccessfully campaigning for a third term in the White House. Today, we're going to learn more about Roosevelt's visits to Vermont and his life in general with Edward Cohn, newly installed Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Norwich University. Dean Cohn, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane. Happy to be here.
So what exactly was happening on August 31st in Barrie in 1912?
Well, Roosevelt had been snubbed by his own Republican Party, the party that had been his home for 30 years. He wasn't able to wrest the nomination from Taft, so he founded his own third party, the Progressive Party, sometimes nicknamed the Bull Moose Party, and he was campaigning on a platform that I think the progressives today would find pretty familiar. I was just reading it before I came on your show, the speech that he gave in Barrie, and the talk about social and industrial justice, equal rights for men and women, an 8-hour workday, a 6-day work week. These sound for us like something that is just matter of fact, but for 1912, this was a fairly radical platform.
Roosevelt had been a member of the Republican Party. Can you do a little comparing and contrasting the values and platforms of the Republican Party at the turn of that century to today and how he then decided to go over and become a progressive?
Roosevelt had always occupied a very specific wing, a reform faction within the Republican Party. And this was often a place to battle the old guard and people who had very close association with business interests. It was not uncommon for senators and congressmen, as well as getting their salary from Washington. They would also be on retainer from a big oil company or a big railroad company. And Roosevelt and a fairly small group of others, like Henry Cabot Lodge in Massachusetts, they were reformers. They wanted an independent civil service. They wanted to make cities safer, cleaner places to live. They wanted to attack corruption. And I always look at that 1912 election when the kind of the Republican old guard, you know, really stomped on Roosevelt's popularity and his ability to achieve that 1912 nomination. When Roosevelt left the Republican Party in 1912, he took a big chunk of that reform wing with him. And I'm just not sure it's ever really gone back into the Republican Party. When we think about Roosevelt as being a key figure in the Progressive Era, a reform era unlike any other in American history, we look at Franklin Roosevelt coming after with the New Deal. We look at Lyndon Johnson coming afterwards with the Great Society. And these, I think, were significantly Democratic presidents.
Ted, before we close the loop on that 1912 speech, why Barrie? Why was he in Barrie to give that speech?
Well, there was a Vermont Progressive Party as well. So there were connections with Vermont. On the one hand, this was part of a campaign tour of New England. And this is actually something that Roosevelt was kind of in the forefront doing as well. In the 19th century, presidential candidates didn't really run for president. They stood for president. It was very kind of unpresidential to look so ambitious that you would actually go out and solicit people's votes. Well, Roosevelt was one of the main figures at the beginning of the 20th century who changed that. Now we expect presidents to visit as many states or as many cities as possible. But the very fact that Roosevelt got in on a train or in a car to come to Vermont, it showed you kind of what a new presidential candidate he was.
Dennis in Burlington emailed, did Roosevelt get involved in Vermont politics, and what support did he get here in his 1912 third party run?
Yeah, he really wasn't advocating any specific candidate. He wasn't on the platform with anybody. He wasn't putting his arm around anybody and voting. The problem for Roosevelt, including in Vermont in 1912, is that for so many third party runs, in the modern times, the third party candidate will be taking votes equally from both parties, both Republican and Democrat, and that wasn't the case in 1912. When Roosevelt took votes away, he was taking them away from William Howard Taft. And so since the Civil War, for the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, Republicans really had a lock on the White House. And what did Theodore Roosevelt do in 1912 to his beloved, at one time, Republican Party? I mean, he completely undercut its chances for taking the White House, and he allowed, really almost single-handedly, the election of Woodrow Wilson, who Roosevelt absolutely despised, especially for Wilson's wavering about entering the First World War. And that was of Roosevelt's own making.
Huh. Ted, can you take us back in time a little bit and just remind us how Teddy Roosevelt came up in politics? And, I mean, by 1912, he'd been president already, so this was his third attempt at the presidency. But talk a little bit about how he developed and became a leading politician.
Now, Roosevelt was a lifelong New Yorker. He was born and raised in Manhattan, and this is really something that helped shape who he was. As an urban progressive, he was always concerned, based on his experience in New York, with how to make cities safer, cleaner places to live. And so he began representing New York City in the New York State Legislature. He did that for a few years. He then went out west, famously, for a couple of years and worked on his own cattle ranches in the Dakota Territory. Then he came back and he held a number of appointed positions in New York City, where he was police commissioner, but also in Washington, D.C. One of the longest stints was as civil service commissioner for 6 years. And that's pretty key, because this was a fairly new government oversight body to make sure that hiring, firing, promotions weren't based simply on who you knew or who you paid, but they were actually based on merit. And Roosevelt had that for 6 years. And it was right about that time when he would pass the White House that he started thinking about someday aspiring to the Oval Office. He then became, after he was police commissioner for 1 year, he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And then he joined the Rough Riders, was in Cuba for a few months, came back, was almost immediately, by the time he set foot on American soil again, was offered the nomination to be governor of the state of New York. Then he was offered the vice presidency in 1900, and of course aspired to the presidency in September of 1901.
Yeah, and we're going to talk more about that, because there's an interesting Vermont connection to how he, sort of tangential, but nonetheless there to how and when he became the president. But let's first go to Susan, who's calling in from Moortown. Hi, Susan. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks. Dean Cohen, I'm just wondering, Roosevelt was able to bust the trusts and the railroads back in the later part of the 19th century and early 20th century, when there was so much wealth and power concentrated with such a few people. And it seems to be quite a similar situation today. And I'm wondering if you see any hope for that kind of progressivism to be successful.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think Roosevelt would have said that he wasn't an enemy of American business. Whenever he gave the State of the Union address when he was president of the United States, he, even though he probably was viewed as an enemy of big corporate business, of trusts and monopolies, he'd all say that government – and business had to be in partnership, that you couldn't just, you know, make laws to try to destroy business or send people to jail. And I think that's a fairly important lesson for today, that I don't think you can set up government or government regulatory agencies or politicians to simply be, you know, the business is our enemy, big business is our enemy, Wall Street is our enemy, we should send Wall Street bankers to jail. I think there has to be kind of more of a symbiotic relationship between the two. And in that sense, if we can actually establish that and realize that, you know, all of us are in this together, that, you know, big business, government, the private citizens need to work together, then dare I say I am slightly optimistic that we can, you know, move forward as a country based on, you know, Theodore Roosevelt's premise.
Do you see politicians today taking that premise and people supporting them?
It's really hard to say today. You know, there's the echo chamber of the media. There are the congressmen who are elected for a two-year term and immediately have to start raising tens of thousands of dollars every week just to get reelection. Obviously, we have opened up through Supreme Court decisions, government and the political process to a whole lot of money and the influence of money. And I do worry, merely as a, both a citizen, as an American historian, about the effect that this will have on the political process. So I think there are a lot of challenges there with the media, with the influence of money, the fact that, you know, corporations have very deep pockets and you need donations from them to get elected to political office. Look at the last presidential election, how many hundreds of millions of dollars were spent, and this is only going to increase. But, you know, I still like to, you know, at least pretend that I'm optimistic about the future.
Let's go to Richmond and hear from John, who's calling in from Richmond. Hi, John. Hey, John.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. I think Roosevelt was probably the first media savvy president. He would often, you know, work around the political bosses, starting in New York and then in Washington, and he would kind of go over their heads to the people if he wasn't able to do it through the traditional means. That being said, he also had tended to have a strong idea of where he wanted to go, and the best example of that, when somebody crossed him, Taft. He had picked Taft as his kind of hand-picked successor, and Taft then went back to the old-style kind of blue-blood Republican policies, and there's this long-term friendship kind of disintegrated because Taft wasn't following the blueprint, so to speak. So he was a unique president and a very effective one.
John, thanks for your comments. Ted, do you agree with what John's saying there?
Yeah, well, I think what John is pointing out is that there was a balance between Roosevelt being media savvy and knowing how to use the media and personal relationships often with journalists, not only for his self-promotion, you know, let's be clear about that, but also as the bully pulpit to advertise his legislative agenda. At the same time, he was also very legislatively savvy as well. And so he was really one of the first presidents who had his own legislative agenda, that he wasn't being passive and waiting for Congress to come up with it, and he would just sign whatever bills he wanted. And Roosevelt, because of his many years in public service, having served in the legislature, having been governor of the largest state of the Union, he would follow bills from the writing process through committees to the readings in the floor of House of Representatives to the Senate until it reached his desk. So it wasn't just that Roosevelt was using the media to bypass Congress. There was a balance there, that he was equally knowledgeable about both the power of the media and about how you actually get things done and get your legislative agenda passed, often passed through some pretty hostile forces in Congress.
Yeah, interesting lessons, as you say, to what we're seeing today in politics. We're talking today about the life of Theodore Roosevelt, and we're also going to be talking about his other visits to Vermont. Today we're talking with Ted Cohn, Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Norwich University. He's an expert on Theodore Roosevelt, and we're hearing some fascinating stories about Roosevelt's life and politics and his connection to the Green Mountain State. Ted Kim emailed, Teddy Roosevelt was a notorious eugenicist, and is looking for some comments from you on that.
I'm not sure I would characterize him as a notorious eugenicist. That was really a movement that came after he died. I mean, this is somebody who, on the one hand, yes, he stressed the strenuous life and being heroic, and he was always concerned with the manly virtues. But, you know, at the same time, you know, I'm not sure there's any moment that he said anything about, you know, what to do with Americans with disabilities or the handicapped. He did advocate the United States being a melting pot. He didn't like the term hyphenated American because he wanted people to learn English and become assimilated, but at the same time, you know, he's somebody who, you know, had famously Booker T. Washington for the first, you know, black man to have, you know, dinner in the White House with the President of the United States. He had Oscar Strauss, a Jew, as part of his cabinet. So, you know, on the one hand, Roosevelt was somebody who was born in 1858. I mean, he was born before the Civil War. He's firmly in that 19th century you know, Victorian tradition. At the same time, he had, you know, his presidency was during the first decade of the American century, the 20th century. And so he's really kind of on the cusp of those kind of 19th century and 20th century ideas.
As we know, here in Vermont, the eugenics movement was pretty powerful, and there were sterilization drives, and particularly targeted at Abnaki people. What was Teddy Roosevelt's relationship like with Native Americans?
Yeah, it was an interesting relationship. One of the most prominent statues to Theodore Roosevelt that still exists today, besides Mount Rushmore, is the statue that's of Roosevelt in front of the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. Roosevelt is on horseback, and he is flanked by an African-American on one side and a Native American on the other side. On the one hand, he had you know, real contact with Native Americans and people of Native American descent, of Métis descent as well. When he was in the Dakota Territory, he worked with cattle hands who were Native Americans. And when he called the Rough Riders to Cuba, one of the reasons they were called the Rough Riders is that most of these men knew how to ride and shoot at the same time, and they were famously a group of cowboys and Indians. At the same time, Roosevelt, once again, you know, shared many of the ideas of the 19th century. He was very paternalistic. At the end of the day, the country, you know, had to kind of take care of Native Americans. And, you know, he didn't, while he might have wanted to respected Native Americans as having the manly pursuits of hunting and living outside and horseback riding. At one point, I think he even said that, you know, at some point, Native Americans will simply kind of disappear, you know, as a separate group on the North American continent. And again, that shows kind of the mix of Roosevelt with kind of these, you know, 20th century views, but also firmly, you know, firmly grounded in the 19th century.
You know, speaking of his reputation there as a rough rider and sort of a swashbuckling type, a cowboy, is that entirely accurate? Does that sort of maybe hide some of perhaps the softer side or the other side of his desire to preserve the outdoors and to really, you know, get people to love nature and the outdoors?
Sure. I mean, this is the multifaceted Roosevelt. He was, on the one hand, for his whole life, he was a amateur natural scientist. He liked bird watching. He liked collecting specimens. When he entered Harvard, he thought he would actually become a professional natural scientist. But of course, he was also an avid hunter. He did, and it was the hunting and wanting to preserve the flora and fauna and the animals that he saw diminishing with each of his hunting trips, ironically, in the 1880s, that was really kind of the beginning of his helping to form the Boone and Crockett Club, which was a private group, we'd call it today a lobby group, you know, that helped create some of the very first national parks. And so today, if you ask, I think, most Americans, well, what is Theodore Roosevelt's greatest legacy? You know, most people would say the national park system. But as well as being somebody who loved the outdoors, you know, he took a trip up the Amazon, of course, which nearly killed him after he was president. He did a year-long African safari. He loved being outside. At the same time, he was Harvard-educated. He traveled the world with his family before he became president of the United States. He spoke fluent German. He read French poetry around those campfires with his, you know, cow hands. He was the author of 40 books. He was an American historian. So, you know, there's really a lot more texture to Roosevelt than just some of the political cartoons that we're left with today. Oh, the Rough Rider and the big floppy hat carrying a big stick. You know, there's also Roosevelt the thinker, Roosevelt the Harvard graduate, and Roosevelt the intellectual.
Hmm. Let's go to Gary calling in from Wilmington. Hi, Gary. What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm very fortunate in that I get to spend my life buying and selling books about Theodore Roosevelt and dealing with all this wonderful ephemera. But I'm always fascinated by the fact that of all the political icons of Lincoln and Washington, who T.R. Just venerated, T.R. today is still the president that both parties associate with. And there's no greater example of that than the fact that John McCain had two chapters on T.R. in his autobiography and felt that he was connected to T.R. Both intellectually and then from a policy point of view. And President Obama went to Osawatomie, Kansas, and on the exact same spot where T.R. delivered the New Nationalism speech, delivered a political speech that was, groundbreaking for his administration. And you couldn't find two more disparate individuals, both channeling T.R. as part of his incredible appeal that seems to only grow with as time passes. It's truly remarkable.
Gary, thanks for your comments. Appreciate hearing from you. Ted, do you think politicians today who attach themselves to Teddy Roosevelt are doing it out of an actual set of shared values and shared mission, or is it a case of attaching yourself to a popular politician who you want people to think of or sort of have in the back of their minds when they think of you, in the same way that, you know, often politicians will connect themselves to Ronald Reagan, say, when actually the policies that they're espousing are not necessarily similar to Reagan's?
I think you're right. I think it's probably the latter, that Roosevelt still remains this larger-than-life figure. And in many ways, as I was saying before, he's so multifaceted that he's a mirror in which I think probably any of us could see at least some bit reflected back in. The warrior who won the Nobel Peace Prize is another one of these great contrasts. But I think also, you know, rather than looking at the fine print of his various policies, you know, what made Roosevelt this historic president? Well, he changed the power of the presidency. He changed the power of the executive branch in ways that are still having ramifications today. He changed American domestic policy. He was the first American president to say, you know, look, the federal government really is responsible for every individual American citizen. And he changed, of course, American foreign policy. At the beginning of the 20th century, as Americans were trying to figure out how do you have a foreign policy commensurate with your size and your economic power, Theodore Roosevelt was one of the first presidents to actually answer that question or to offer an answer. So for all of those reasons, Theodore Roosevelt, no matter what party you ascribe to, this is an enormous figure on the American landscape that absolutely I, as an American historian, am very happy to be associated with, but he has a political legacy for our leaders today.
When you say he changed the power of the presidency, how?
Well, the story that that I like to tell is that, you know, in the previous years, presidents had looked at the Constitution and looked at the enumerated powers and said to themselves, okay, this is what I can do. Roosevelt looked at all the things the Constitution didn't say and said, well, then this gives me a whole new range of powers as well. And we can see the way he used this in many ways, like having his own legislative agenda, like sending the Great White Fleet on a global tour, like seizing the Panama Canal zone, which he famously said, I seized it and I let Congress debate. So there are lots of times that rose, like establishing the National Park System, using the Antiquities Act, which gives the power of the president the right to declare national parks, national monuments, basically with a stroke of a pen. So these are all things that Roosevelt really kind of got the ball rolling. And during wartime, Franklin Roosevelt with the New Deal in the 60s, during the Cold War, this has kind of snowballed, really snowballed probably until Richard Nixon had the imperial presidency. But this is Roosevelt always having to have action, never can be passive, and there's no way that President Roosevelt could have been a passive president. So he made the presidency, a real, and the president himself, a very active figure, and really one that kind of Americans could identify with. He and his family and his children and their life in the White House were the fodder almost daily of news reports. And so it was this idea that, the person in the White House is someone that we feel we know, that we want to have a beer with, not some distant, aloof figure like Washington or Lincoln, only carved in marble. Now, I think Roosevelt helped change the presidency that way, too.
When you talk about him being somebody that people felt a connection to, we got a note from Prudence who says, my parents were older, so my mother had many stories of Teddy Roosevelt, who her older siblings worshipped. I grew up hearing many of these third-hand tales, and one of my cousins was named for him. And here's one story, she writes. T.R. visited his friend, naturalist and Vermont resident George Cherry, at least two times after their trip down the River of Doubt in South America. Cherry lived in Wordsboro, and Roosevelt would catch the train from New York and disembark in Brattleboro. Prudence wants to know, are there any writings in his journals about Brattleboro?
No, and I've never heard that story before. The thing about Theodore Roosevelt's diaries and journals, on the one hand, he was an avid list maker and journal maker. There are papers from when he is in the White House and making a list of birds that he saw around the White House. He kept diaries for about 10 years of his life, from when he was at Harvard to through when he was married, started his legislative career, and went out west. He kept a diary when he was with the Rough Riders, but he often kept diaries with the idea specifically to write something off of it later on. So often some of these journals ended up being his books and publications on ranch life or the Spanish-American War. So I haven't come across anything about this trip, which sounds great. I'd love to have a copy of that email. I don't know anything about that trip, but I have a feeling by that time we're getting close to when Roosevelt died in 1919. He's not making too many diary or journals at that point.
Before I let you go, we can't not ask you about this trip to Isle La Motte in 1901, because this is a kind of an important part of the story of American presidency. What was he doing and what happened in September of 1901?
Yeah, Jane, I know we don't have too much time left, but the day before he had been at Burlington talking to a veterans reunion, and he gave a speech on brotherhood and heroics that I'm thinking about, giving to the Norwich cadets here. And then he, on the next day, he was having lunch at the Vermont Game and League Game and Fish League when the announcement came that there had been an assassination attempt on September 6th of William McKinley. And he got a private yacht to take him back to Burlington, and then he got a special train to Buffalo to be at the bedside of William McKinley. So Vermont has a very important place in the history of Roosevelt and in American history, too.
Well, I appreciate you telling us a little bit about Teddy Roosevelt. Are you inflicting this now on all of the students at Norwich University? They have to learn about Roosevelt in order to graduate.
Yeah, it's going to be a required class. They don't know that yet, but they soon will.
Edward Cohn is Dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Norwich University, and he joined us from the studio on campus at WNUB-FM. He's written several books about Roosevelt, including Heir to the Empire City, New York, and The Making of Theodore Roosevelt. Ted, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jane.